It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a ride on a moving museum.
First, the latest snapshot in the race for governor is in with the release of the new WPR St. Norbert survey. Big picture among registered voters, Scott Walker is ahead with 46% of those surveyed compared to 43% for Mary Burke. Among likely voters, that lead narrows to 47 to 46%. Both results are within the margin of error and both have an undecided vote big enough to swing the race.
But the survey also tried to dig into why voters supported their candidate or why they hadn't made up their minds yet. Wendy Scattergood joins us to share those findings. She's assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College, where she works with the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. Wendy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, beyond the head-to-head part of the survey, you tried to figure out why voters support their candidates. How hard is it in polling to measure that kind of thing?
It's fairly difficult. One of the ways that we do it, in fact, this is always my favorite question to do, is to ask an open-ended question of what was the primary or the biggest factor in your vote choice for that person. And that really gives us a lot of detailed information because the people who work in the Strategic Research Institute, they're just typing in exactly what the people say. So I find that the most interesting way of trying to get at what are the issues and what are the characteristics of the candidates that people are really thinking about in their vote choice.
Well, and looking at the results, looking at the whole survey, I've got to say this was the number or the set of numbers that leapt out at me. Can you tell us about the top reasons for supporting Governor Walker and the top reason for supporting Mary Burke?
Yeah, this was really interesting. So the primary reason for supporting Scott Walker was his track record. The general policies, people think that things are going on the right track. They like him. They agree with his values. And 40% of the people who were voting for Scott Walker said that was their reason. On the Mary Burke side, the primary reason, 61% of Mary Burke voters said that this was an anti-Walker vote. So what's interesting about that is they're not per se voting for her as much as they're voting against Walker.
That seems amazing. I don't know if you ask this regularly in governor's races, but is this an outlier? Is this a normal thing for it to be so much about the incumbent?
Mm-hmm. It's fairly normal. I would say we do ask this question, and it is higher than I expected, although not out of the ballpark unexpected. And we do definitely see when you have a challenger running against an incumbent that you're going to find that sort of anti-incumbent sentiment.
And another thing that surprised me from that question is for supporters of Governor Walker, only 4% listed Act 10, right? This big controversial centerpiece of his career as governor. 4% said that's why they support the governor.
Right. But I think a lot of the people were taking a lot of issues together, and that's where they're saying, I agree with his policies more generally. And then also, a lot of people wanted to say a lot of things.
Okay.
So they just will list them out in a big, long list. And because we really only code for one thing, I code the first thing that they say. So in some cases, Act 10 may be in their long list of things, but it may not come out as the number one thing.
So yeah, it might be surprising if a lot of people said this one policy and this one thing alone rather than that as part of the whole.
Right, which is good. I mean, it's good that people are looking at, you know, sort of more complex set of issues rather than just being single-issue voters.
Well, looking at issue by issue, you also asked the people you surveyed to compare the expected performance on a variety of issues between Scott Walker and Mary Burke. So let's start with the money stuff, jobs, budget, taxes, that sort of thing. Where did people fall on that?
Generally, people thought that Scott Walker would do a better job. It's fairly equal on the creating jobs in Wisconsin. 47% said that Scott Walker would be better at it versus 45% for Mary Burke. The budget is a little bit bigger. 52% thought that Scott Walker would be better at it than 44% for Mary Burke. And same with taxes. There's quite a range. But when we get to health care, very, very polarized and very equal. 44% think that Scott Walker would be better at health care in Wisconsin versus 45% for Mary Burke.
And what issues does Mary Burke come out ahead on?
She comes out ahead on education and the environment, as well as healing the partisan conflict. this last one, the healing the partisan conflict, had the highest percentage of people saying neither would do that.
So maybe there's a core of people out there who think neither party is going to be the one that that fixes the partisan rift.
Right, and a lot of those are the people who are definitely going to vote but haven't made up their mind yet. That's a big chunk of those folks. When I look through all of those categories that we just talked about with jobs and budget and taxes and environment, education, when you're looking at the people who aren't sure who they're going to vote for yet, they were primarily the people that are more likely to say neither, although they actually, a little bit later when we talked about sort of Act 10, they are, for the most part, opposed to that, and they're supportive of Mary Burke's Affordable Care Act support.
Well, that's it. And I know both parties and all political pundits are trying to figure out what that small group of undecided voters is looking at. And it sounds like, compared to the rest of us, they are uncertain about what can be done about the partisan divide.
Yeah, that's very much true. That's why I think we saw a lot of neither candidate would be better. They're also very cynical about the direction of the state. Their approval ratings for Walker are very low. They also rate the economic conditions in the state as fairly low, lower than either of the more partisan voters. So they're pretty cynical about what's going on, which, you know, it could favor Burke because a lot of those indicators are being associated with Walker. And I think when we look at some of the issues with Mary Burke, I think they're just not sure. I think they're just very skeptical about somebody trying to make things better, but they definitely don't like Scott Walker.
Well, it's interesting. They have cynicism. They're not happy with performance. They don't necessarily trust either party. But these are still, we're talking about people who consider themselves likely voters.
Yeah, these are people that said they would definitely vote on November. And that's pretty indicative of Wisconsin being, we have one of the highest turnout rates in the country. And, you know, a lot of people feel that civic duty, but it makes it really difficult when you have these ambivalent feelings of not really liking either party or just being unsure who's really going to do a better job. The people who weren't sure who they're going to vote for were much more likely to watch the debates. 42% of them said they watched the debates, compared to only 17% of Walker voters and 19% of Mary Burke voters. But the plurality of those debate watchers were not sure actually who won, which again shows that ambivalence.
Well, that speaks maybe to the relevance of debates. The undecided voters are watching them in much larger numbers than the people who know who they're going to vote for.
Yeah, absolutely, which is why they are very relevant and important.
Well, one more way you try to get into voter motivation is for each major party candidate, you ran different positives and negatives by people to see if it made them less likely, more likely, or no effect on their voting. Just wanted to hit a couple that have come up in ads a lot. Scott Walker not meeting his goal to create 250,000 jobs. What did voters say about that?
Well, it's most interesting when you break that down by who they're going to vote for. Mm-hmm. So for the people who are going to vote for Scott Walker and, frankly, Republicans, they say it just doesn't matter to their vote. Mary Burke voters, Democrats, think that it does, you know, it would make them less likely to vote, which shouldn't be a surprise. But of the not-sures, 42% of them said that it would be less likely to make them vote for Scott Walker.
And were there any other things pro or con with Scott Walker? You asked about reducing taxes, the John Doe investigation. Did any of those sway the not sure voters?
The one thing that popped out the most was actually Act 10. And 62% of the not sure voters said that it would make them less likely to vote for Scott Walker. And I thought that was kind of an interesting finding. Probably the thing that Walker has most in his favor for the not-sures is the tax issue.
Interesting. And how about on Mary Burke's side? What stood out as making the undecided voters more or less likely to vote for her?
It was the Affordable Care Act. They were very split here, saying that the plurality of them, 34%, said that it would make them less likely to vote for her, but then there was almost an equal amount saying that it would make them more. So they're definitely interested in that, but they're kind of split on that. The undecideds also liked her experience at Trek.
Well, I bet candidates are going to look at these numbers to figure out what they do in their last couple of weeks of advertising. Thank you, Wendy, so much for sharing this info with us.
Sure, you're welcome.
That was Wendy Scattergood with the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute talking about today's WPR St. Norbert College survey results. You can see more info and results at WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As turning leaves signal another Wisconsin autumn, the Mid-Continent Railway Museum gets popular. It's an outdoor living museum, an operating railroad recreating the small-town short line way of life during the golden age of railroading, with operating trains and restored railroad cars to take passengers along a scenic 7-mile route that begins in North Freedom, Wisconsin.
Jeffrey Bloom joins us now. He's the president of the Mid-Continent Railway Museum. Jeffrey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first, paint us a picture. What does the leaf scene look like right now at the train windows?
Well, if I were at the museum right now and looking out the train window, we'd be past peak. The peak colors appeared last weekend, the 18th and 19th, when we ran our pumpkin special. But right now, we're past peak.
So this is something for people to put on their calendars, look ahead to next year, but there's still got to be some beautiful scenery out there. What route does the train take?
The train leaves our depot at the museum just west of the village of North Freedom, and then it meanders in a south-southwesterly direction 3.5 miles to the end of the track, and it goes alongside of a swampy area where the Baraboo River used to run, but it changed course. Then it goes through farm fields, corn fields, soybean, and then it goes through a woods, and then past some more farm fields, and then it goes through the little mining town of LaRue, where it crosses the Sealy Creek trestle. And then it goes through a wooded, swampy area all the way to end the track at an area we call Quartzsite Lake. And the colors on all the trees, because many of them are maple trees along the way, very brilliant hues of reds, oranges, yellows. And then off in the distance, the riders can see what is known as the Baraboo Bluffs, 4 or 5 miles distant. And when the sun is out, of course, that's just all bright with colors.
Now, do you just run during the fall color season, or can we take the train ride other parts of the year as well?
The museum operates trains beginning the Mother's Day weekend, and we run weekends in May. And then when school's let out, about the 8th of June, we open up 7 days a week. And then when September rolls around and the kids go back to school, then we go weekends again until the third weekend in October. And the second weekend in October is what we call our autumn color trains. And the third weekend in October is the pumpkin special, where we have a pumpkin farmer bring in a lot of pumpkins at the end of the track. And the people ride the train, and they can buy a pumpkin from the farmer, and then they haul it back on the train.
Now let's hear about these trains a little bit more. What kind are they?
Mid-Continent strives to collect equipment from the 1884 to 1916 era, known as the Golden Age of Railroading. However, that old equipment is very historic and kind of fragile. What we operate on a daily basis is passenger cars that are made of all steel, but they were built in 1914, so they still got that old look. We would love to run our trains with steam locomotives, but all of our steam locomotives are out of service right now due to needing heavy repairs. And when I say heavy repairs, I mean over $1 million.
Wow.
So we're running vintage diesel locomotives. One of our star attractions is a 1944 Elko Model S1 switch engine. And that's historic in itself because Elko hasn't built locomotives since 1969. And the diesels will pull like two coaches and a historic wooden caboose on our normal runs.
Now, what is, I know a lot of people love older trains. What's the appeal? What's the allure of seeing these trains and actually riding them in action?
Well, the difference between riding our train rather than a modern commuter train or Amtrak, our equipment is all old. You go up the steps on the cars, they're open platforms. Then you go in a doorway to go in the coach. You can slide the windows open. And, of course, you know, modern railroad cars today, you can't open the windows. Everything is air-conditioned. And they're the old-fashioned flip-over seats. And our conductor comes through the train with a vintage uniform on, the punch tickets, just like it was done in the old days. We try to recreate a small short line railroad environment, and with the equipment we're using, being some of it's 1914 and the locomotive's 1944, I guess you'd have to say they'd step back in time to 1944.
Wow. Well, aside from that, what else does the museum have in its collection?
The museum has a very large collection. The prize are the wooden passenger and wooden freight cars. The oldest car we have was built in 1864, and then we have a group around 1903, and then when you start to get into the steel part, 1914 to 1915. We do have many of our old wooden coaches and freight cars completely restored. And the people that come to the museum, they not only can ride the train, but we do have a museum grounds also, and they can, you know, walk around at their leisure and look at this equipment. Mid-Continent has one of the largest collections of any railroad museum in the United States of vintage wooden railroad equipment. Many of the cars are one of a kind.
And Jeffrey, who does work like that? Who restores these old wooden passenger cars for you?
Mid-Continent is made up of around 500 members, and like all organizations of that size, about 80 are active. And we have departments within the museum. And the department that takes care of restoring the wooden equipment is what we call the restorations department. The restorations department is housed in a very large building, a building, you know, large enough to put 8 or 9 railroad cars in. And this group of members strives on doing the carpenter work, et cetera, et cetera. And we also, you know, sometimes have to hire outside contractors also.
So most of these people are volunteer members of the group showing up maybe on weekends or whenever they get time off to work on these cars?
We have a very large pool of volunteers on the weekends. Our trains on the weekends are run by volunteers. The mechanics working on the locomotives on the weekends are volunteers. And the people working on the wooden cars for restoration are volunteers. However, we do have paid staff also. The Monday through Friday trains in the summer, we have a paid crew on that because, you know, you wouldn't get enough volunteers for five, you know, Monday through Friday when it's a work day. And the same thing with the restoration department. We do have some people that we do pay to do certain work that the volunteers, you know, wouldn't be able to do.
And, Jeff, we've just got a couple of seconds here. Is there a wish list, one thing you'd like to add to your collection?
Well, our collection is pretty much complete. The big wish list is we do not have enough money to go around. That's the big wish list. If we had enough revenue coming in, we could have a steam locomotive running pretty quickly.
All right, Jeffrey, we'll leave it there. Good luck with that, and thanks for joining us.
Okay.
That was Jeffrey Bloom. He's the president of the Mid-Continent Railway Museum in North Freedom, Wisconsin.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a guest clears up myths and misconceptions about Native Americans and other indigenous peoples around the world.
On Food Friday, amaze your friends and family by serving them pretzels at the next Packer game. Wait, homemade pretzels, yeah.
That's coming up tomorrow, right here on Central Time.
Still to come today, we look at what happens when judges have to hit the campaign trail and how that campaigning affects public trust in the judicial system. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Our series of candidate forums continues later in the program, and we'll be talking with one of the candidates running for the first congressional district seat.
First, the ideal of an independent judiciary is as old as the country itself, but 39 states, including Wisconsin, elect justices to state courts, raising questions about how to balance judicial politicking and impartiality.
In the wake of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling of 2010, judicial races have seen an explosion of spending on ads by outside groups. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, these groups spent $24 million on judicial races during the last election cycle.
Journalist James Oliphant recently hit the campaign trail with a North Carolina Supreme Court justice. His recent article in the National Journal examines what happens when judges court constituents and cash. James, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you hit the campaign trail with, as we mentioned, a judge running for Supreme Court in North Carolina. Their election's going on now. Ours are in an off season, usually here in Wisconsin. You've covered, I think, political campaigns before. Did riding along with a judge feel any different than somebody running for Congress or something like that?
Well, it did and it didn't. It did in the sense that, you know, in a sense, campaign events are campaign events. But the scale is much smaller, even with a congressman or something like that. I basically rode along with a sitting justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. And as I point out in the article, she actually had me drive her car to a judicial candidates forum in North Carolina. So it was basically just her and me, and she didn't have a staff around her, no handlers, no press people, nothing like that. And she's basically, her name's Sherry Beasley, and she's just basically been out there this summer stumping on her own for her Supreme Court seat.
And she had to ask for money like a candidate for any other office. Was there discomfort in having to do that?
Yeah, she was. She admitted to be it's not the most pleasant aspect of her job. Some of the other justices that I interviewed expressed an outright distaste for it. Justice Beasley did not, but some of the other justices called it the dreaded call time and felt very uncomfortable reaching out and asking donors for money. And an important point of all of this is exactly who they're asking to give that money, which donors are you asking for that money?
Well, presumably, a lot of this if I'm a donor, the most likely person I'm going to be is somebody who's going to have an issue in front of a court.
That's correct. I mean, these are very small circles of donors, and we're talking about lawyers, large law firms, trade groups, businesses with an interest before the Supreme Court. And those are the people who are going to have any sort of information, any sort of awareness of the race. One of the biggest problems with Supreme Court elections is that these are low information races. Most voters have no idea who's running for a state Supreme Court. And that makes money disproportionately effective in races like these.
Well, stepping back from that particular race, a lot of states have elections for Supreme Court justices, state Supreme Court, other levels in the judiciary. Why? Why have so many states gone toward elections for their judges?
Well, you can talk about the good government aspect of it. I mean, it does ensure some level of political accountability for these judges and these justices. And it does go along with the idea that we should not treat candidates for the court any differently than we treat candidates for other political office. And, you know, and that it's good for justices and judges to face the voters. In North Carolina, it's every 10 years or every 8 years. I understand in Wisconsin, it's every 10 years. But at the same time, other states have moved toward an appointment or some sort of merit retention system where candidates are screened by specialized boards or they're appointed by the governor or the state legislature, all with the idea of maybe pre-screening some of these candidates to make sure that they are actually fit for office.
And in, I think, most, maybe all cases, these are technically nonpartisan elections. You don't run as the Republican or Democratic candidate. I know that's the case in the one that you followed and here in Wisconsin. In practice, though, does it really play out that way?
No, that's a complete fiction. And just about everybody in North Carolina knew it. You know, and it wasn't hard to discover somebody's political affiliation. They run in nonpartisan primaries, but it's very clear who the Democrat is and who the Republican is. And in this case, judges on both sides, they were endorsed by their respective state parties. So that basically takes any sort of pretense out of the equation.
And we mentioned in the intro there, Citizens United and money going into campaigns and into outside groups. How does that fit in with the election of judges?
Well, it's brought a whole new dimension to it in that it's given outside groups the capacity now to mount attack campaigns against certain justices. We saw that this spring in North Carolina, a justice who is considered leaning Democratic, she was up in a primary, and a group in North Carolina was formed a third-party group and spent almost $1 million trying to unseat her. It didn't work, but it's a sign of things to come, and it's a sign of what we're going to see across the country. There's a group in Washington called the Republican State Leadership Committee, which has started what it calls its Judicial Fairness Initiative. And what it's trying to do basically is ensure that there are conservative justices on state Supreme Courts to basically safeguard legislative accomplishments by conservative legislatures. And we've certainly seen that in Wisconsin with Governor Walker's labor reforms being upheld by your state Supreme Court this summer.
And our last Supreme Court election definitely got tied up in the recall campaign and everything and the court progress of Act 10, that particular law. You, in your piece, refer to Supreme Court races in Iowa and elsewhere in the country getting the national funding and national attention that you just mentioned. Can you talk through some of those cases?
Well, what we're seeing basically is the nationalization of these races, just like we're seeing in Senate races and House races across the country. And it goes to the idea of these outside groups. It all sort of started in 2010. You might recall the recall of the three Iowa Supreme Court justices who had voted in favor of same-sex marriage. That sort of got the ball rolling, and the idea that outside political money could begin to influence the outcome of these races. And I think we're going to only see this phenomenon grow and grow in coming years.
So you mentioned a Republican national group aimed at these state judicial elections. Is there any kind of response from national Democrats or their supporters?
We really haven't seen that. There was a group formed recently on the ground in North Carolina, but it's a North Carolina group. But I don't think it's a stretch to think that unions and other Democratic groups will eventually get involved. It's just the nature of the beast.
Now, one solution that some states have tried in an effort to get some of the money out of judicial races is public financing for judicial elections. We had that for a while in Wisconsin. It has since been repealed. I gather that's also the case in North Carolina. What are the pros and cons of public financing of elections for judges?
Well, it was passed in North Carolina at the beginning of last decade, and the idea was to sort of level the playing field for candidates and reduce the incentives to have to go out there and solicit money. And by many accounts, it worked. The justice that I profiled, Justice Beasley, she's an African-American woman who got her start as a public defender down in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And so her job, and she eventually became a trial judge down there. And so she didn't have the kind of background where she had a lot of extensive business contacts in the legal community or industry contacts, the kinds of relationships that lead to political influence, lead to political appointments. And the idea of the public financing system, rather, was to give candidates like this a fair shot at being elected to the Supreme Court. Now, Justice Beasley ran for the State Court of Appeals there using the public financing program back in 08. Now, as she's standing for re-election on North Carolina Supreme Court, she has to raise money like everybody else. And she's at a great disadvantage vis-a-vis her opponent, who's backed by not only the state Republican Party, but the Chamber of Commerce and business groups throughout the state.
Well, the core concern of people who worry about candidates for judge having to go out and fundraise for an election is, are they going to be able to be impartial if their donors come before them in a court? You talked to candidates on different sides of elections there. What kind of things did you hear from the candidates as to how they'd address that?
Well, this has been an issue throughout the race. There are four seats up on the North Carolina Supreme Court, which is, I believe, historically unprecedented in that state. And the idea of influence has been following this election pretty much since the primary this spring. And to a man or to a woman, each of the candidates has said, well, I'm not for sale. You know, a campaign donation isn't going to buy my support in an opinion, or it's not going to influence me in terms of a judicial decision. And of course, that's exactly what they're going to say. But that has not stopped some of the justices from adopting some ideological positions in representing themselves to the voters.
And one solution that's sometimes offered is the idea of, okay, recusal. If you've got a big donor in front of you, fine, you just sit this one out. Is that a common practice, though?
It is not. And as a matter of fact, the United States Supreme Court in 2009 examined this very question. And it basically, in a decision that was upheld or released by the conservative majority, they raised the bar. They established an extremely high standard for recusal in these situations. It's not enough, the court said, that you donated to the campaign of someone who ends up on the bench. You had to do something much more active, like, say, form a political action committee dedicated to unseating that justice's opponent, as was the case in that case.
We're talking about judicial elections and what happens when judges have to go out and raise money and shake hands on the campaign trail.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you feel that the process of electing judges could compromise their impartiality? What do you think about the influence of outside interest groups? And how have you seen Citizens United play out in Wisconsin? Should there be stricter rules on how judges campaign and with what money? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the influence of money and politics in the judicial system, especially in states like Wisconsin that have elections for the Supreme Court and other judicial posts.
James Oliphant is with us. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like that we elect, say, our state Supreme Court justices here in Wisconsin? Is that a good idea? Or would you rather see some kind of merit selection? Do you think a campaign donations call into question the impartiality of judges, especially when their donors appear before them in court? And would you like to see the state's public financing law, it was called the Impartial Justice Law, returned here in Wisconsin? Call now at 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. James, does there seem to be any kind of movement to change things to get money out of judicial races in the country, or are people just kind of accepting the status quo?
Well, I'm afraid the trends are going the other way. And one of the problems is that this has all been bound up with the trend that we're seeing on the national level, which is deregulation of campaign finance. So it's become sort of an article of faith among Republicans to repeal public financing laws and to basically open up these elections to outside influences and big money. And, you know, I should add that when you do that, it basically rewards big donors, industry groups, and helps cement the outcome of some of these races. So there's very little incentive, at least on the Republican side, for any sort of legislative reforms. And so we're basically at a situation now where The judicial arena is just a few years behind the political arena, but I think we're going to see it catch up very quickly.
Now, outside of the money, you touched on this a little earlier. The laws have changed and the customs have changed as far as what judges can say when they're out campaigning, what ideological stances they can take, what they say about particular issues. How has that evolved?
Well, it's interesting. There was a case before the U.S. Supreme Court about 10 years ago, which basically examined whether judicial candidates have the same free speech rights as other political candidates. And the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, they do. And what we've seen now is it takes the form in some pretty mild situations. I was at a candidates forum in Charlotte, North Carolina, where a justice who obviously identified as a Republican said he disagreed with the Supreme Court's finding in the Affordable Care Act case that the law was constitutional. So that clearly sort of marked the boundaries of his ideology, where another justice said she disagreed with the Citizens United decision, and so that clearly marked her ideological view. And we're going to see more and more of this, I think. No judge or judicial candidate is going to come out and say, I'm going to vote X in a pending case. I think that's still off limits. But in terms of signaling to voters what their judicial philosophy is, that's A-OK now, and I think we're going to see a lot more of it.
We've talked a lot about how the campaign could affect the impartiality of a judge who gets elected in their term. But also, does knowing that you'll need to campaign again make you kind of look over your shoulder and wonder what decision, what opinion could be an attack at in the future?
I think you've hit on a very concerning topic for justices. When I talked to Justice Beasley, we talked about whether a dissent would be used against her by her opponent that she wrote in a business case. And it turned out that the very forum we were driving to, her opponent brought it up right away, signaling to the crowd that he believed that she was anti-business and he was pro-business. And it may provide a political disincentive for justices on state Supreme Courts to take unpopular opinions, to side with defendant rights, or to to do anything that could be manipulated into saying that they're soft on crime. As we all know, that's a favorite theme for campaign ads. There are worries about a chilling effect on judicial independence.
You mentioned Supreme Court races or court races in general being low information races where voters don't have a lot to work with. Are attack ads like the ones you just mentioned, picking out one opinion among many, particularly effective in that environment?
Well, it's interesting because there was a widespread belief in North Carolina that the attack ad that was aired against the justice in the primary, Justice Hudson, backfired because all the attention it received in the press ended up boosting her name recognition to the point where she now credits the attack ad for surviving the primary. And if she goes on and survives the general election, it may be just for that very reason. And so that is one significant difference between judicial elections and, say, Senate and House races, where name recognition is less of an issue. An attack ad can end up serving the victim better than the attacker.
You know, when I think of politicians out on the campaign trail, I definitely think of a specific type of personality, the natural politician, outgoing, extroverted. Is that necessarily the common judicial personality?
No, and we talk a lot about what judicial temperament is, and you have to remember that these people are lawyers. They went to law school. They, in most cases, they were clerks. They're people who love the law. They love to read the law. They love to argue about the law. And they got into the field because they're scholars. They're people who care about nuance. And politics is about anything but nuance, right? It's about the big statement. It's about the promise. It's about ideology. And so it's put a lot of these candidates in very uncomfortable positions because they're not naturally gregarious people. They're people who, and as some of the candidates confessed to me, they were looking forward to actually going back and being able to work on a decision and read the briefs and be sort of cloistered away again from the political arena.
I want to bring a caller in here now. We've got Emily on the line in Racine. Emily, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Emily?
Well, I was just calling because it just seems a little frustrating to me that, with lobbying, it seems like our government is bought off by big business. And if we allow our elections for judicial elections to be influenced by big money and big business, don't you think that our judges will make their decisions based on favor as opposed to the facts in the case.
Emily, thanks for the call. James, your thoughts on that question?
Well, it's certainly a concern of advocates and good government groups that that will be the case. And it may not be that there's a direct link established, say, between a donor and an outcome. But the idea that a candidate backed by the state chamber of commerce will have a certain philosophy that will be reliable, that will end up protecting the business interests of the state, or that you can sort of predict how somebody will go in a given case, is a concern. And it's why in the federal level, we don't elect our judges. We appoint them. And now that has its own problems, obviously. But it's to help project that sense of integrity, the sense that the judges are above the fray.
And beyond the integrity and the impartiality, I mean, I think of the founding fathers, and maybe I have my civics lessons wrong, as wanting the judicial system, the judiciary as a whole, to be a little more insulated from the day-to-day politics of the time. Is that just a sort of ideal that never happened, or is that some reality that we've moved away from?
No, I think it is a reality that we've moved away from, that and it's sort of just, the progression of modern life, that everything has become so polarized and politicized, and that our judiciary, our state judiciaries are becoming like that. And it's also, it speaks to, though, the modern environment, which money can play such a fundamental role in shaping the outcome of these races. And what we're seeing is that the groups are catching on, and that a legislative agenda accomplished can be a short-term gain without a judiciary backing it up. And the trends are on both sides for these issues to be litigated. Think about, again, the Affordable Care Act on the federal level. So what you want to try to do is guarantee an outcome. That's what this is all about, on the legislative level, on the executive level, and on the judicial level.
Yeah, we've seen that at the state level, where a lot of things that go through the legislature and are signed by a governor don't really happen until they make their way up through the courts. Is that a national trend as well in other states? And is that something that's going to keep raising the stakes and the financial stakes for these judicial elections?
Yeah, the courts have become a great weapon in sort of the struggle between the conservatives and the liberals. And as we've seen with voter ID, as we saw with Governor Walker's labor reforms, as we've seen with the Affordable Care Act, we've seen it with Dodd-Frank, anything that is sort of a strong policy component is going to be litigated for its constitutionality and its legitimacy. And so courts, you could argue, have never played a greater role in the legislative process than they're playing right now.
We'll leave it there. James, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was James Oliphant. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal.
Coming up next, our series of candidate forums continues. We'll be talking with a Democratic challenger in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District.
And speaking of elections, join us Friday night at 7 for the Wisconsin 2014 Attorney General Debate, sponsored by Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The debate will feature the front-running candidates in the race for Wisconsin's Attorney General. It's moderated by WPR's Sean Johnson and WPT's Frederica Freiberg. That's the Wisconsin 2014 Attorney General Debate, Friday night at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.